Hi, everyone. Welcome to the February monthly policy update. I'm Brenna Stroop with Independent Sector. Today, we will be joined by my IS colleagues, Jamie, Allison, and Becca, as well as Wes Golem from Washington Council Ernst & Young. Before we get into today's agenda, I want to go over a few housekeeping details. As part of our conference call feature, all the lines are currently muted, and we will pause periodically for questions from you. If you have any questions, you can unmute yourself by pressing *6. And then we ask you to please mute yourself again by pressing *6 as well. If you have any technical difficulties, please send me an email at brennas@independentsector.org. As well, as if you have any issues hearing, please let us know if there's any problems with that. We look forward to your questions today, and we really appreciate your attendance. And I will turn it over to Jamie now.
Thanks so much, Brenna. Thanks, everyone, for joining the call this afternoon. A lot has happened, and in some ways nothing has happened since the last time we talked, but there's a lot of movement, some good news on the federal spending front that we'll get into with Wes and our team in D.C. But wanted to take a moment first just to peel back again and do a quick spotlight on the tax situation in D.C. and around the country. As we discussed in January, as we all know, a new tax regime is in place that has a lot of implications for the work of our organizations and for those that we serve. Independent Sector and many other organizations are continuing to push to learn, to have conversations with lawmakers about the impact of this proposal. From our perspective, there's still a great concern in terms of charitable giving. And we'll update you in just a couple of minutes on some of the activities, some of the things that we're doing to try to get a better handle on what's happening on the tax front. But Wes, I do want to turn to you for a minute. We've heard various things that there might be an extenders package at some point in this year. We're seeing more and more that there are pieces of the tax law that Congress might want to take a look at. Unintended consequences is a phrase I've seen thrown around a lot about various pieces. And certainly we had that statement to make last year with respect to tax reform and the impact on giving. So, you know, from your perspective, at least in the near term of 2018, how is sort of the tax piece continuing to evolve? And might there be any opportunity for the sector to talk about some of the issues that we raised last year?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, we're kind of in the post-tax reform period this year, given the bill, big bill passed in December of last year. There has been some tax activity early this part of the year, and some more on the horizon potentially going forward in the short term. First off, they did in the most recent CR did pass a handful of about 30 or so expiring tax extender provisions that had expired at the end of 2016, and they extended them for 1 year through 2017. There was hope they would try to get them for 2 full years, which is what the Senate was pushing for, but the House pushed back, and ultimately they only agreed on doing a one-year extension of those provisions till through 2017. So they're expired again for 18, and the hope is to try to get them extended for another year as part of the next CR that is due to be debated and voted on by March 23rd. So there's that activity going on there. There was a couple of small provisions that were dropped out of the bigger bill due to BIRD rule provisions, BIRD reconciliation rules on the private foundation side, as well as one for the endowment tax for a certain college. Those were fixed or added back into the bill that passed recently. So it could be a couple small efforts as well to some more of those items that were dropped out of the bigger package in December due to the reconciliation rules and the so-called BIRD rules that limited some provisions from being included in the final bill. And we do expect, as I mentioned, that they will do try to do another year of the miscellaneous or the package about 30 or so tax provisions that were expired at the end of December 2017. And so there's some more action potentially on the tax front in this next CR. We also have to look at the FAA authorization for the funding for the FAA trust fund expires at the end of March. It's also on the table to be discussed as part of this package as well.
Thanks, Wes. I want to turn to Allison and Brennan in just a moment, who've been doing a number of meetings at the beginning part of this year with folks who are on the tax running committees in both the House and Senate to kind of get a sense where there may be opportunity to continue to discuss a number of the charitable issues from a year ago and where we might need to still provide some education. And one of those pieces is the Johnson Amendment. Despite the victory, and I think we discussed this last month as well, there's still a push from some in Congress to make this a reality. It did not happen in the most recent iteration of the continuing resolution, although it does seem that the omnibus will be another opportunity to attempt to make some changes, whether it be through some restrictive language and funding, or even perhaps inserting language from the Free Speech and Fairness Act that is both in the House and Senate, that would not completely repeal the Johnson Amendment, but basically fundamentally render it non-effective. So, Allison, Brenna, what have we been learning from these conversations with lawmakers, and kind of how is IS positioning itself into 2018?
Great, Jamie. I think Brenna and I are going to tag team a little bit on providing an update, but I will go ahead and get started. We've been having quite a few conversations with policymakers in 2018 just to sort of confirm or at least explore a little bit more about what their position is on the Johnson Amendment to get a better sense of if there is an interest in slipping this into another bill this year. What we've been hearing, we had primarily conversations on the Senate side, in part because it seems that is where, as a sector, we have a few more allies. And basically, there's bipartisan agreement that the efforts to repeal or weaken the Johnson Amendment is not a good idea. Generally, the Senate agrees with the sector and understands a lot of our concerns and even some of the more technical challenges associated with the proposals that are currently out there. The challenge that we've heard, which we heard also last year in these conversations, is especially from Republican lawmakers, although they agree with us on our position regarding the Johnson Amendment, they also acknowledge if it is included as a part of a larger bill, as a rider on any kind of larger bill that, you know, has some kind of political momentum to pass, it's not necessarily the kind of issue that will prompt them to hold up the passage of a bill. And so that's the part where I think independent sector, we remain a little bit concerned, and while we are continuing to work to educate policymakers on the dire consequences that are associated with this proposal and why it is so critical that it does not get included in any bill, and also the fact that it is really controversial. So tacking this on to potential legislation will make must-pass legislation less appealing for a bipartisan vote. That's what we've been hearing so far. I want to quickly turn to Brenna. And Brenna, have I missed anything as far as our meetings go?
No, I think the only other thing I'd mention is that the education level has gotten a lot better. So us going up there and talking with offices and keeping them up to date on what's going on has been, they said, to be really helpful. But the one thing that they've mentioned is important it is that we're up there talking to them, that it's more important for them to hear from the constituents directly about why it would affect them.
Absolutely. That is something that was driven home a lot of meetings. And actually, some of them said they were influenced in their position, in part based on, you know, it's not good policy, but more importantly, that they did hear from constituents in their districts and in their states saying this is a bad idea. We did also hear from someone who was involved in the tax reform process on the House side last year who said he felt like there is broader quiet support for a repeal than we would think. And so there is enough interest, and the people who want to repeal the Johnson Amendment made enough progress in 2017 that they are probably going to keep pushing this. So we've also been encouraged by various members of the Hill and even some advocates to keep up this educational effort that Brenna mentioned of continuing to raise awareness about the issue, especially on the House side, where there seems to be more buy-in for repeal. That being said, there is, the appropriations bill is not a done deal yet. And there are coalitions that are working to make sure that this education process is accelerated just in case a Johnson Amendment repeal gets added to appropriations bill. What they are planning on doing is actually advocating around not including any controversial riders in a final appropriations bill, something called a clean bill. And they are scheduling a call-in day on March 6th. And the group that's organizing it is Public Citizen. If you're interested in learning more, please feel free to reach out to Lisa Gilbert with Public Citizen. Her email is lgilbert@citizen.org. And we also can provide you with talking points and one-pagers that they have available. And I think the other thing that we're encouraging, our policy newsletter went out yesterday. We had a call to action in there that was just saying, please, if you haven't done so recently, reach out to both your House and Senate members of Congress just to make sure they understand where you stand on this issue and have your networks do the same. They can't, it cannot hurt for them to hear from us and reiterate that we think this is a bad idea. With that, I'm going to stop and check back in with Brenna.
I think you covered everything.
Great.
And just awesome. We will make sure to send out that information in the follow-up email so that you all have it as well.
Thank you, Brenna and Allison. And, one of the other things, in addition to Johnson, we have been talking to folks about the universal charitable deduction. And I know many of our partners in the Charitable Giving Coalition are continuing to up that drumbeat as well. And trying to best understand what the environment's going to be moving forward, where a window may exist to continue to discuss this very critical issue. From what we understand, the preliminary conversations is that some form of data collection is going to be very important, trying to understand the impact of the new law, how we might be able to mitigate, where we might be able to bolster giving and expanding and increasing giving is one of the most important policy aims for independent sector in the 2018 and beyond. So we'll continue to have those conversations. I will say on sort of a good news front that there are several members of the Senate Finance Committee who are open to working on a more expansive look at a universal deduction or some comparable policy to increase giving. That's very encouraging. We're going to continue those conversations throughout the year and into next year. Allison, I will pause just for a minute to see if you have anything else to add on this piece. But it does seem that data collection in many different forms is going to be critical to this effort.
Jamie, the only thing that I would add is we at Independent Sector are working on trying to figure out what data collection is already underway and what that data may be able to tell us within this year and what parts of the tax policy may not really come to light until 2019 or 2020. So we're working to figure that out with researchers who work on giving data all the time. Simultaneously, we've heard quite a bit from some nonprofits that say, we send out annual surveys to our members or networks, or we feel like we want to do more in the short term to figure this out. So being responsive to that request, we're doing two things. One is in our conversation with researchers, we're actually trying to identify what gaps remain as far as what we understand that researchers can't answer on their own. And in answering that question, we may take an approach that's twofold. One, possibly commission a formal survey of nonprofits in the sector with nationally representative sampling methodology and things like that. But the other thing is we may just do a more anecdotal ad hoc approach of asking the sector to collect sort of two or three key variables that if they're willing to report it up to their national organizations or to independent sector or other similar infrastructure groups, we'll work to aggregate that data and try to sort of piece together as complete of a picture as possible as to what's happening on the ground. That being said, I do want to reiterate, we did a little bit of reflection on sort of what worked well in 2017 and what did not. And one of the things that advocates recognized was missing from our conversations in tax reform in 2017 was we talked about how the tax bill would reduce giving, but we didn't necessarily attach that data of it will reduce giving by up to $20 billion to stories of what that impact really would look like on the ground in communities. And that's information that we can only get from organizations at the state and local levels. So in trying to learn that lesson, I think we're going to in the future be reaching out to everybody on the phone and a broader network to try to figure out how to fill in that gap of collecting stories that we can tell to policymakers to make any information that we have a bit more real and have it ring true as far as this is what it will mean as far as the services provided in your community. So even if we don't necessarily have a universal set of two or three variables we want the entire sector to collect around giving, I do think, and stay tuned, we'll actually come out with something a little more formal in the coming weeks, but it'll probably be some kind of request of, please, can you start collecting giving stories? And I think we actually might be looking for both positive and negative giving stories. What I mean by that is, here's the power of what giving does in our community and why we're able to make where we live a better place because of charitable giving. Because I'm not sure we always necessarily tie the giving to the impact as well as we could. And then the second story is, and here's the changes that we are starting to notice among donors this year so far. It may be the type of donor, it may be the numbers of donors, it may be the amount donors are giving. We're not entirely sure, but any kind of clue or indication that nonprofits are seeing on the ground is fodder that we can capture and then repackage for a Hill audience. Jamie, that was much longer of an update than I had intended, so I'm going to stop and turn it back over to you.
Allison, that sounds great, and certainly an important piece to keep an eye on, something that we're very committed to. Wes, I want to turn back to you. You kind of alluded to the more expansive budget framework that was agreed to earlier in February. It does set up the need to continue to push and to actually come to some spending decisions for the remainder of fiscal year 2018 and leading into fiscal year 2019. The good news about this agreement is that in this two-year framework, we are going to see some increases in spending, at least lifting the caps a bit, and some other commitments, I think, to CHIP and other policies that are really important to the sector. But the devil remains in the details. We don't have the actual spending allocations worked out. There's still a lot of conversations to have before March 23rd. So kind of looking at it from the sector's perspective, what should we be watching out for? What potential pitfalls are out there over the next few weeks? And certainly, we talked about the Johnson Amendment as something that we're concerned about that might sneak in as a compromise issue. But what else out there should we really be looking at?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. As you mentioned, the budget agreement they reached to in February basically increased the spending caps for defense and non-defense spending the next 2 years. So basically a two-year agreement to increase the spending amounts for both non-defense and defense. The non-defense discretionary pot was about $60 billion for the next fiscal year. So they're trying to kind of figure out how to allocate those funds amongst the various appropriations bills and draft an omnibus appropriations bill for agreement and passage by March 23rd. We think they'll, we're working towards. We think they'll achieve. Obviously, the immigration issue, and now with the the gun control issue, is also very timely. That might play into the debate as well. They get to the omnibus package and how it plays out. So a lot of things to watch and moving pieces to watch as they debate the issue moving into March. On the spending side, I think that they need to watch the details what they put in the package. I think it was a victory for those who want to have more spending in their programs to have the higher caps for this year and next year, and so gives both appropriators ability to have more flexibility to fund various programs. But you need to obviously watch the details of how those appropriations bills are crafted and drafted when the final versions come out closer to the middle of March. On the tax side, like I said, they're going to do probably another year of the expired provisions that were extended through the end of 2017. There could be an effort to try to do some additional tax provisions in there relating to the tax reform bill passed in December. But the Democrats have been of the view that they were not part of the process in the tax bill. They opposed the tax bill. And so they wanted to have any sort of technical corrections or other changes to the tax bill go through the regular order process before they allow them to be attached to the bigger package. There is one provision out there dealing with co-ops. It needs to be fixed regarding the 20% to pass-through business income deduction that has caused some market problems in the farming community. They're trying to fix. That's one exception that might actually get done in the bigger package if they can agree to it, given that it's problems in the market. So, things to watch. But I don't think that other than the Johnson Amendment, I don't think there's going to be things on the horizon that will be negative for the sector. I don't foresee them trying to do any sort of revenue raisers or tax increases as part of this package to pay for the extenders package. They've been of the view the extender package should be unpaid for. That's how it's been done. It was how it was done the last bill. And so we'll see how that plays out. But I don't expect big tax increases. I don't expect there to be much of an opportunity for the sector to go in and try to get big things done as far as the universal deduction is concerned, for example. Given the context of what they're talking about in the omnibus appropriations bill, I think that's going to be something to be dealt with, later on in the future as part of tax legislation, much later in the year or next year. They're also trying to do some technical corrections to the tax bill. But like I said, the Democrats have been of the view that they want to kind of not agree to those quickly and just go to the regular order process. So the Republicans are in the view of trying to figure out the technical changes to the tax bill and try to put them together at some point later on in this year, see if they can move them at a future date. So I don't see those coming together for this bill either. Jamie, as far as anything to watch, I think the Johnson Amendment really is the one area I think that people need to be vigilant about to watch and see if that appears in the conversation. It was not on the table as part of the February 9th CR budget process, and so we're hoping that it's not become an issue or on the table as part of the March bill. Definitely need to kind of watch the process and watch the conversation on that issue.
And Wes, a really quick aside before we move on, and we will pause for questions in just a moment. I did mention the immigration issue, understanding that some of the debates around DACA did not go very far in the Senate over the past week. Is there a continued possibility? I know the conversations are still happening, but are we looking at another potential government shutdown in a few weeks over this issue, or perhaps over guns or anything else, safety issues? It does seem that while the two sides are trying to work toward agreement on any number of things, they still seem also far apart. So just wondering kind of your handicap of the potential of another shutdown.
Yeah, I think it's definitely not impossible. And so it's possible it could happen, but I don't see it being very likely. I think that both sides have learned from the shutdown experience that it's not advantageous for either side to let a shutdown happen. And so there'll probably be some talk about that, and it'll go up to the wire potentially given the disagreements. But I don't see the shutdown actually happening. But it certainly is possible if talks really do break down some of these things and they get stuck on various issues and decide to go that route. But I think the experience of the previous couple of CRs, they've kind of backed away from the brinkmanship of actually doing a government shutdown. On the immigration side, obviously it's still out there. They did not find a bill or proposal that could get the votes in the Senate. They had four different packages that all failed to get 60 votes. And so they kind of moved on. When the Senate comes back next week, they'll move on to other issues. There is some talk of trying to do some modest or very scaled down immigration proposals as part of the March 23rd package. I think that's still a ways away from coming together, and it could not come together at all. And so it could be an issue they have to deal with after the March 23rd. But I think they're still trying to figure that out and how that proceeds. And so there definitely is a chance they could reach impasse and want to delay that debate. But I think they're still trying to figure that out and how it works. But I don't see the shutdown in this environment actually happening. They've got agreement on those budget issues. They want to get the appropriations bills done and finished. I think both sides are working towards the spending details, and I think that should come together by the end of March. And so I don't see a shutdown happening, but definitely it's likely, but I don't think it's very, very likely.
Thanks, Wes. And before we pause for questions, I do want to pivot quickly to the president's budget, which rolled out on February 12th with somewhat little fanfares compared, I think, to past years. And some of that may have to do with the fact that we do have a broader congressional agreement in place for the next 2 years. With respect to the Trump administration's budget, there weren't very many surprises, I think, on a policy front. There was some discussion of an infrastructure plan, some federal investment there, an investment for a border wall. We saw, I think this year as well, proposals to cut any number of agencies and social programs, the continued type of proposals to cut the NEA, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and many others. You know, not atypical, I think, from what we saw from the previous budget. It did seem the cuts were not quite as draconian this time around than what we saw kind of in the first policy document last year. But understanding the president's budget is non-binding, it does provide an insight into the administration's priorities. But, you know, my question to you, Wes, is like, how impactful will this document be in helping shape policy for the rest of the year? Given that we do have some movement on the congressional side, is there anything we can take away from the president's budget that should either be of concern or something that we should be paying even closer attention to, maybe something that we wouldn't see on the surface?
Yeah, I think, you know, the president's budget, I think, from, you know, as most budgets are, is fairly dead on arrival when it was put out, and it's, you know, more, illustrative than, you know, a binding document at all on the Capitol Hill. And the appropriators in the House and the Senate tend to look at it, but they don't are not dictated by its contents. You know, going to go forward with their appropriations bills that they draft. You know, as you mentioned, the president did put out a lot of spending cuts in there. You know, on different programs, but the spending deal they just reached on February 9th gave them actually more money to spend in various areas, given the budget caps were increased, and so they have a little more leeway to avoid some of those cuts. And so I think that most of the cuts in the president's budget will not appear in the appropriations bills they put out in March. But definitely something to watch. That's where the the administration's position is, and so they'll obviously be inserting their positions in the conversations. But you know, the appropriations bills and the CRs need to pass both the House and Senate with majority votes and CD votes in the Senate. It requires a bipartisan process, and so you have both sides having to agree to what happens or what gets done in those final bills. And so I think that, you know, in that context, there'll be pushback on those cuts in the president's budget. And so while they're there, I don't think they're going to be materialized in the appropriations process.
Thanks, Wes. And, you know, we said and mentioned this is kind of a non-binding, it's a policy document, yet it certainly gives every reason for nonprofits who see issues, programs, other pieces that either have been targeted for elimination or a significant scale back to kind of raise the alarm and have conversations with lawmakers about the importance of them. I think that the education done by any number of parts of the sector on, you know, critical programs have been very effective over the years, have staved off a lot of cuts and potential, other issues. So, yes, it might be DOA, but the advocacy still matters, and letting the people who are kind of in charge of the purse strings understand why that is and why the impact they have in the communities is always important, remains important. And, you know, I am personally impressed by the work done throughout the sector, particularly in times of crisis, whenever you see programs from anywhere from block grants to endowments up on the chopping block and kind of making a case for that. And certainly this year is no exception to the need to continue to do so. So Wes, you talked a bit about some of the other policy priorities. Wondering what are the other must-do items for the rest of the spring?
Yeah, so in addition to the funding bill, they have to do FAA reauthorization expires on March 31st. I'm looking at doing a farm bill this year and some higher education legislation as well. There's also some pension issues out there on the multi-employer pension side they're looking to try to deal with as well. There is, desire to do something on the ACA stabilization issues, the dealing with the insurance markets. They're part of the conversation from Senator Collins, as you know, from others, Senator Alexander and Senator Murray during the tax bill debate in the fall. We could see some additional health care legislation possibly as part of the March 23rd omnibus or later. The president's also been talking about infrastructure legislation and spending as well. It seems to be not gaining really good traction, but definitely the conversation is progressing in the House and the Senate. It's going to take some time for them to figure out what to do on that and it could be a while, but that's something also they want to do. Not a must-pass item, but something they're looking at trying to do if they can this year.
Thank you, Wes. And as I promised, we will pause now for questions. We have been talking for quite a while, so please hit star six on your phone if you have a question. Okay, hearing none. Allison, I want to turn to you for a second, and Wes, you may have some commentary on this piece as well. Another issue that we are following and know that others have been working on much more closely is net neutrality. Some understanding that the order put together by the FCC will be published tomorrow, I believe, or at least sometime in the next week. Allison, what can you tell us about that?
Sure, Jamie. I guess we get to provide breaking news. The Federal Communications Commission put out in the Federal Register today, they published in the Federal Register, their plans for rolling back net neutrality rules that were established under the Obama administration today. And basically, it anticipates that the rules will end, or the net neutrality rules or protections that are in place will end as of April 23rd. For those of you who haven't been on prior calls and we've talked about this, I think we've also discussed it a little bit on our podcast. The reason we're calling the sector's attention to this issue is sort of what it means for our organizations and the people we serve. Net neutrality rules that were created under the Obama administration forbid telecom companies from sort of what they call throttling, so speeding up or slowing down internet traffic or usage based on a ability to pay. It basically took the idea that the internet is sort of a public good that needs to be more heavily regulated, and therefore it was not the kind of thing that could be used in the marketplace in that way. So what has happened is that the Federal Communications Commission, which has a Republican majority, decided in December to roll back those rules and to allow telecommunications firms to do that kind of throttling if they wanted to. I think the general belief is that won't happen. And so we're sort of creating regulations for circumstances that will never come to pass. But the vast majority of internet companies and digital companies are really worried about this change. The sector, with the exception of a couple of large foundations, has not been particularly active on this issue. But we want to point out that what this could mean if telecom companies are able to throttle information, it means one of two things. Either they could end up charging more to the people who host websites. So that would mean nonprofits who historically have less ability to pay at higher rates may end up having all the nonprofit sector content be slower on the internet, which would make it harder for donors to access, but even more importantly, more difficult for users or constituents to access if needed. So that's an initial concern. And then the other is sort of the end result concern, which is one of the other ways that telecommunication firms could take advantage of the repeal of these rules is to charge actual internet users higher rates to get faster and faster internet. And so then you have to worry about what does this mean for widening any kind of digital divide that exists in the country, particularly for rural or low-income households. So it just raises a lot of questions and issues that we want to make sure the sector is aware of. Again, April 23rd is the projected date as to when these rules may end. We know that there are some efforts by Democrats in the legislature to try to stop it, but and Wes can speak more to this, there doesn't really seem to be a lot of confidence that they will succeed, given both the Republican majorities in Congress as well as the Trump administration supports rolling back these rules. There are also efforts to challenge this issue in courts, including over 20 state attorneys general are looking to file lawsuits. Unfortunately, when you're taking the legal advocacy route, and Jamie, you know more about this than I do, it can be a really long and arduous road. So there's no guarantee that, you know, nonprofits wouldn't necessarily feel the impact of this rule repeal, I guess I'll call it, before it makes its way all the way through a court system.
Yes, Wes, I think the only thing I'd add is I just don't see any likelihood that the Congress would take up legislation overturn these the action on the FCC. And, you know, certainly there's some Republicans who support the prior rules, but for the most part, it's probably not supported by the Republican conference. And so I just don't see the House in particular making any legislation to change the rules.
Thanks, Wes and Allison. And I would agree, it's a difficult situation. I think short of an injunction from federal court, which is pretty tough to get, particularly on a kind of a rulemaking issue from an agency that had the authority to do so and did so democratically through a vote, you know, unless the case could be made that was, you know, particularly egregious, it'd be very tough to do. I do think it's an issue that will continue to evolve, one we will continue to monitor and play any role that we can on behalf of the sector. But Allison, thank you for the update. Do want to pause again for any questions for anything that we've talked about so far. Before I do that, Becca Vucic also joining us today. I was hoping Becca could give us a bit of an update about kind of the new IS experience in terms of we're not really calling it a conference anymore. We're calling it Upswell. Upswell will be the gathering that Independent Sector is putting on for the sector in the fall. So Becca, what can you tell us about Upswell?
Yeah, so Upswell is growing out of the tradition of the formerly Independent Sector Annual Conference, which brings together leaders from nonprofits and foundations once a year to learn and connect with each other. We're kind of reimagining it this year, reimagining the very notion of a conference. So the aim is to create a highly interactive experience where changemakers can learn new skills, build deeper relationships, be out in the community. But most importantly, they want to focus on collaborating on action-oriented projects. So Upswell is where we'll create change together rather than just talking about it. The inaugural Upswell event will take place in LA this year. The dates are November 14th through 16th. You can find more information about the actual conference location or the Upswell location on www.upswell.org. So now that you've heard a little bit about what Upswell is, I'd like to have a brief discussion about potential content. I'd like to note that we have started having these conversations in other groups and have interestingly found that we don't have a lot of agreement on just a few topics. There were a lot of ideas, and we found that no one issue received more than 3 votes, and there was only one that received 2 as well. So with that in mind, thinking about your organization and your network, what resonates with you as far as potential topics that need to be addressed at Upswell? And just a reminder to press, I think it's *6 to unmute yourself.
Would you want to give a couple examples, maybe?
Yeah, so the 2 issues that received the highest, and again, that only received 3 votes, were tax policy and education. And then the one behind that was giving. Some of the other topics include budget appropriation, oversight and rulemaking, inequality, safety net, health, civic engagement, the image of the sector, and housing. Those were just a handful of the topics that have already been brought up. So let me, I'll ask this. Do we have any policy opportunities or events that we see on the horizon for 2019 for which the sector needs to prepare that we could discuss?
And if folks want to take some time to think about these questions a bit, you know, we can certainly send this out in writing as well and look forward to responses, but we do want to provide some opportunity now to have part of the discussion. So Becca, back to you.
Yeah, so in the meantime, we're in the process of integrating a lot of the feedback that we have already received into our overall design. But while we're working on that in the meantime, if you run across a topic, a potential speaker or format suggestion, please feel free to reach out to me directly at Rebecca V, R-E-B-E-C-C-A, V, at independentsectors.org, or just give me a call.
We'll pause just one more moment, see if there are any comments for Rebecca before moving on. Okay, hearing none, we'll go to the last piece of our prepared agenda, and then I'll turn back to my colleagues for any items we may have missed, and certainly open it up to you as well for anything you'd like to raise or highlight. Did want to make you aware, though, we talked about a few of these items, a number of tools and resources from Independent Sector and our partners in 2018. Hopefully all of you saw the newsletter that Voices for Good that was published yesterday or sent to your inboxes yesterday. That has a commitment from us to continue to deliver and policy content, in a format that's digestible, that highlights a lot of what's going on, and we'll kind of catch you up a bit in between our MPUs. In addition to the digest, we've begun season 3 of a podcast, which has been renamed to Voices for Good as well, to kind of take advantage of the branding a bit. But, you know, it's another way, another opportunity to kind of bring information to you. And one of the things that, you know, we want to continue to hear, that's been a great part of the learning conversations, is learning more about how you like to collect information from us, how the kind of resources that you need from us, things that we can do to help make your work and your advocacy more effective. We want to have an open dialogue throughout 2018 and beyond, and provide you as many feedback opportunities as we can, so we continue to do, adapt, learn, and put forward tools, resources, products, information that is most helpful to you. So I will kick to my colleagues. Is there anything I missed in terms of the resources, tools, or any other big picture issues that we should discuss with the group today?
Hi, Jamie. This is Brenna. While we're on that topic of resources, one of the things that we wanted to bring up before we got off the call today was in the conversations we had around post-tax reform and lessons learned and things we could be doing better as a sector. One of the big items was that people felt that there was room for improvement in communicating with each other. And so one of the ideas that we had come up with was creating a Slack community for people that worked in the policy field and the sector, and just making an easy way for people to communicate in real time other than just emails or calls like this. So ways for you to communicate in between these things. So we did create a Slack community, and we sent out an invite to quite a few people on Friday. So if you received that email, we ask that you please join. It came from our colleague Jeff Moore. And if this is something that you're interested in and you didn't get an invite to it, please reach out to us and let us know. We will be happy to forward the invite to you. You can email me, Brenna, at brennas@independentsector.org. My email is also on the event for this event, the event page for that, so you can find it on there as well. Or just reach out to any of us, and we will be happy to forward you the invite, and just kind of a community that makes things easy to use. So if you use Slack or if you don't, it's basically like an instant messenger kind of service. And so we've created channels for kind of a wide swath of different topic areas that we thought might be helpful to start out conversations, get that rolling. And if there's anything else anyone on my team wants to add to that kind of area,
I mean, I think, Brenna, the only thing that I would add, and why I think this is a great idea, that both is sort of a collection between Brenna, Becca, and our colleague Christina in communications came up with as a solution, is we don't really view this as an independent sector forum. This is for the people who are interested in cross-cutting policy issues to use in ways that are helpful to you. So if you have ideas on how to use it better or improve it, let us know. If you want to create additional sub-channels on topics that you think people might want to join and discuss, we can absolutely do that. This is very much an experiment in trying to be responsive to the sector, but also seeing if there's really demand for this. And so we're really looking forward to having this be a learning process, and would welcome any feedback you'd like to provide. And this is Becca. I do want to also add that if you have received this and you would like to, if you received the invite and would like to participate, and if you also know of a colleague or someone in your network that should also be a part of this, please feel free to forward the invite to them as well.
Thank you, team. And I would say, you know, from personal experience, Slack is pretty easy to use if you haven't. It's great real-time communication. While this is an experimental IS platform, the content is yours. The ability to connect with folks around the sector is something that we are really hoping to do through the Nonprofit Action Network, at least. I think that's the name of the Slack network, right, Brenna?
Yep.
And, you know, look forward to you joining and experimenting with us. I think there are lots of great ways we can build connections across the sector, across the country, and we're really excited about it. So that's it for us for today. I will pause one more time to see if there's any thoughts, questions, or comments before we close. We, again, always appreciate your time. So I'm going to stop for about 5-6 seconds, and then we'll close the call. Okay, well, hearing none, thanks again, everyone, for your time. Thank you to my colleagues, Allison, Brenna, and Becca, and thanks always to Washington Council and Wes for their insight and counsel on these important issues. We'll see you again in March, but in between, you'll be hearing from us quite a bit on issues ranging from the Johnson Amendment, charitable giving, and also federal spending and beyond. And just stay on the lookout, and we'll continue to pump out content and opportunities for you to engage as they become available. Thanks so much.
Thank you.